The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
It is time for On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by a man who will indulge in one Dr. Pepper a day, at least. That's Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Will you ever go over your limit of one?
I tell you what, Kyle, I've cut it back a little bit, and I've had some pressure on the home front to cut it back a little bit. I feel guilty. For having, I don't have one a day anymore.
What is it now?
I don't know. Maybe a couple a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because there's a Dr. Pepper. And no one can see this, of course, because you're listening, but there's a Dr. Pepper on the table here. So I hope
there's
you'll...
There's some left in there.
Yeah.
It's probably been there for a while.
I hope you'll recycle it.
I will recycle.
Okay. What do you think our guest today, Sean Bormette, would think about you drinking Dr. Peppers? He's a pretty fit guy, and I'm really excited to have Sean Bormette on the show. He's first-year head wrestling coach at Michigan. He's been with the program for a long time, wrestled there, but he gets his crack at taking a head coaching job in Division I, which is the crown jewel in our sport.
We'll have to ask him sometime what he thinks of Dr. Pepper.
Maybe that's
like a new question we ask. Like, what do college coaches think of Dr. Pepper?
Just every guest we have, we should just ask them.
It seems like college wrestling coaches are, you know, maybe split down the middle on whether soda's the worst thing in the world or whether you can enjoy one here and there. Well, Gable, he's a huge Mountain Dew guy.
It just doesn't make sense. Whereas the Brothers are the exact opposite. They just won't drink pop.
Schwab, I think he enjoys... Yeah. Some Mountain Dew here and there.
I know
Chris Bono was telling Sparks one time, you know, Shane Sparks was down in a soda, and Chris Bono, the famous line was, would you put regular unleaded in a Ferrari or a Lamborghini? I think that's what. So we'll have to get a sampling of opinions.
I think so. I think that's a good line of question. Just across the board, what do you think about pop?
Around the country might not even know what we're talking about. Pop.
Well, soda, sugary drinks.
Yeah.
I don't know what we have.
Remember when the guys from Allendale were here a few weeks back and Gable was telling the story about how they... Were you there when he was telling the story about how they'd mix in some Mountain Dew?
The Burley Juice. Great story. And Gatorade has a lot of sugar, too.
Gatorade and Mountain Dew is the drink that they refueled with after weigh-ins, right?
It's just pretty amazing to think about in hindsight. But just nice jolt of caffeine. You get some of those electrolytes going back through. So you
get energized, focused.
And it's so good.
Makes you so strong.
Yeah, it does. It's all those things. And I think that, hey... Going into this 2019 season, I think that Sean Bormette is really the right choice. I'm glad he got that job. He deserves that job, given his history and what he's done. I think he gets a fair shake at this, and I think he's going to be a good coach.
Well, it sure seemed like things were pointing in that direction for a while. At least from my vantage point, it seemed like, all right, when Joe McFarland's time is up, when he decides to hang it up, that's going to be Sean's job. And he's got a roster that's pretty strong coming back. You lose a couple guys in those upper weights with Adam Kuhn. That's a huge loss, obviously. Dom Abinader making the stand finally after numerous round of 12 appearances. Those are big losses, but you start that lineup with Michich coming back. You got Amin coming back. You got Pantaleo coming back. Massa, so on and so forth. There's just a lot of firepower. And then you supplement that with Kanan Store coming in. You got a powerful recruiting class. Joey Silva coming in. Mason Paris coming in. Cadet World Champ Will Lawan coming in. And then they've backed that up. With a 2019 commit and Kurt McHenry, a couple-time Cadet World Champ. So their foundation is strong and will be, I think, for years to come, as long as they can keep those guys healthy, keep them all moving in the right direction. But I think they're things are trending upward for Michigan wrestling.
He's an energetic guy, too. Just being around him, you can tell he really is all in on the sport, and we get a chance to talk with Sean Bormet, so stick around for that interview. Our topic, again, is metrics in wrestling, and I think people are pushing us to find a solution, namely Justin Tritz, who is the owner-operator of TrackWrestling.com. Is that the right terminology? I want to make sure I give him the right
founder,
title. Founder.
General manager.
Okay.
I think Travis Shives, a loyal listener of ours, VP of sports up at Sports Engine, I think Travis is intrigued by this stuff too. He was blowing us up on via text message here a couple weeks ago, last week, I think, challenging us to push the envelope here a little bit. We're great, Kyle. One of our strengths is passing off work to others, coming up with ideas.
But we're generating it now. The more we've had some dialogue and we're discussing it, we're coming up with some real metrics. And the more that you bring up ideas, it kind of generates more ideas for me. So it's the healthy dialogue that we're having. And I think we've come up with somewhat of a solution. And I think that we are on the very infancy stages here, but I think we have some ideas on what could happen.
We need to pull some numbers people into the game here. Some people that deal with numbers, statistics on a regular basis. But I think we're on the right track.
I think
with
we
some.
Are too. Yeah.
You know, we like to, like, so much of our business is like a copycat business, like with ideas that come from other places. And one of the things that, like, you know, we talk baseball a lot, and baseball is such a great game from a numerical standpoint that they have really evolved. The sport of baseball has really evolved when it comes to analytics and things like that. One of the things that you look at now in newspapers or even online, and next to the standings, you'll see run differential now. Runs scored, runs allowed, differential. And over the course of 162 games, and we've even seen it for the first half of the season, by and large, we were looking at this the other day, and we can pull it up again here, but by and large, the teams that have the highest run differential on the positive side are the ones at the top of the standings. The ones that are the worst run differentials are at the bottom of the standings. The ones that are hovering right about zero are right in the middle. I think, what did we look? That there were only three teams in the big leagues that had a negative run differential and still had a winning record.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And this is still a little bit of small sample size. We're not, I think over the course of 162, that will get evened out and the run differential will be reflective of where teams are in the standings too. So we're kind of playing around with this a little bit.
One of the challenges that wrestling poses to us and that we're kind of filtering through, and we don't know if this is necessarily the right choice, is that in baseball, football, basketball, there's nothing that ends the game immediately. I mean, there's nothing that says, hey, the game's over within 1 minute. And so we have to deal with that in wrestling. So what do you do with the fall? So our solution to that was to make a fall, and this is strictly through college wrestling, worth 22 points, because the most possible points you can get for a technical fall is 21 points. If you're up by 14, you can get a 6-point move plus riding time. That equals 21 points. So we're saying you have to have a fall worth more than the maximum amount of points for a technical fall. So what we did is we went through and we just picked five people that we thought would be interesting to get their initial analytics. Of course, you get positive points for a 1-point win, so you would get a plus one for a 1-point win, a negative one for a 1-point loss, 22 points for a fall, negative 22 points for losing by fall. So we took Zane Rutherford first, which it was fascinating. So a total of 535 points over 31 matches equates to a 17.2.
So you average more than a technical fall.
More than a technical fall.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just ridiculous.
And let's rewind just a minute here. The reason we're doing this, too, is the fact that we've been banging the drum over the course of, I don't know, probably a year plus now, that college dual meet scoring needs to be revamped. because one of the examples is, well, you know, that I keep going back to is Brandon Sorensen versus Anthony Kalika in the dual meet a couple years ago down in Stillwater. Kalika won by 1 second of riding time, and that equals the same amount as if you beat somebody 7-0 with 5 minutes of riding time.
Yeah. And that just doesn't equate to the, that's not fair.
Doesn't paint the same picture.
It doesn't. And not anywhere near that. And just from the vantage point of, think what it does for the fan to be there and to just look at the scoreboard all the time and see where you are and to know that it's a constant flow of activity and the score is cumulative and you're watching the clock just like you would in basketball. And at the end, it's like you get 3, you get 4, you get 5, or you get 6. And some people don't even know what it is. They've been following it for 10 years and they still have to ask, what's the differential for a major decision? You eliminate all that. You add a new dynamic because you're following it throughout the entirety of the dual meet. And it pushes you to score points even if you're losing. If you're down 7-2, what do I care if I lose 7-2? It's still 3 points. Hey, the guy that's down 7-2 can close the gap and make it 7-4. You just saved your team some points. You added to the cumulative points. And so right now, we don't have a system where dual meets really count for anything. Why not do it? Why not give it a try? The naysayers are going to say, if you get a fall and then the other 9 guys win by a point, you're going to win the dual meet. I say, fine. I'm okay with that. Because if you're putting a premium on the fall and dual meets really don't matter and the matches still count for your record and what you do at the Nationals, let's have fun. Let's roll the dice and see what we can do.
Kyle, I think back to the biggest dual meet that we had this past season, and one of the biggest dual meets we've ever had. Ohio State at Penn State comes down to the final match, Kyle Snyder versus Nick Nevels. And unless you're sitting at home keeping score on a notepad or your laptop or whatever, the cumulative points, you don't know how many points Kyle Snyder needs to win by for Ohio State to win the dual meet. And if you're in a sports bar watching it on TV and you can't hear what they're saying on the Big Ten network, you don't know. So I think that it's one way that makes our sport easier to follow.
Yeah, makes it easier to follow, and it's fun.
And not to mention, it also increases activity, in my opinion, because I keep going back to 2013 National Duels up in Minneapolis and 2,400 people in the stands. And that's a whole separate conversation. But when I was up there, the drive home from that event, I spent 4 hours in the car thinking about dual meets and college wrestling and how can we make this better and what's wrong and what can be fixed. And I watched a lot of matches that weekend where guys would be up 2, 3, 4 points in the third period and nothing is happening because there's no incentive at that point to take risk. You know, you get one more takedown, you get two more takedowns. If you're up two, you got a lot of work to do in the third period to get a major decision. And the risk versus the reward, putting yourself in danger, costing your team, you know, potentially 6 points, maybe even more on a swing, not worth the reward. So I just think from an activity standpoint, I think we need to find a way to reward the guys that are winning by 6 and 7 points more than the guys that are winning by 1 point or 2 points.
So who's the coach that would at least just try it? Say, of course, the NCAA is not going to allow it, but just say, we're going to try this just as an exhibition to see how it shakes out. Get two coaches on board and just see what it looks like. The problem's going to be the pin, because if you're up 8-4 and then it ends the match, you have to take away points. How is that going to look when you get 22 points? Is there going to be a math equation that you have to take at the end? So maybe you do have the cumulative scoring. You see it throughout. It's like the fall happens. Now we have to take away all those guys' points and then give them 22. That's going to be a little awkward, but that's something I think you can
People adjust,
out.
Right, though?
Yeah, they do. It'd be kind of cool, too.
Over time, if 22 points is the point value for a fall, and you've got guys that you're trying to offset that, you might not be a pinner. Well, go get somebody that can go out and get 8, 10, 12 takedowns in a match.
Yeah.
You know, that can set the world on fire on his feet. So I don't know. Like, who's the coach that would do it?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. Look up at that board. Look up at our whiteboard. How many names up there do you see that would jump on? Like, Tom Ryan comes to mind.
I think Tom Ryan's would.
Like a progressive-minded guy that could see the value in this.
I think Doug Schwab would do it. I've had a conversation with him about that.
I think so.
He said coaches aren't really on board with that thinking, but I think Doug likes it and would try it. And if he got another coach that would hop on board with it, I think it might be a younger coach to do that, but I think there's some possibilities there, and just give it a try. Just, of course, have your regular scoring, but then just see what it looks like, see how the fans react, and just give it a try. Maybe it's even at the All-Star meet. Why not try it at that exhibition? Go in East and West and see where it shakes out and just try some new concepts. Doesn't hurt.
Yeah. So after we get done asking them their thoughts of soda, from now on, we got to ask their thoughts on soda, and we'll ask their thoughts on, you know, are we on to something here, or have we lost our marbles thinking this way?
I'm with you. Every single coach we have on, we're going to ask him that question. Yep. I think we're spot on. You've just really invigorated me to think about that, because that's got to be a line of questioning. I don't know when we do that in the interview, but we're going to ask him about that. So we said 17.2 for Zane Rutherford, which is ridiculous.
That's insane.
And the other thing you can do too, this is, we talk about breaking down metrics in Major League Baseball, you can do it so that it's metrics against Division I opponents, so that you can see where do they really fall against D1, against D3, D2. Break it down too. This is cumulative, so this includes many other competition. This could include junior college, D3, D2. So you could break it down as much as you want, but this for the season, he had 17.2. Contrast that with one of the rivals of Zane Rutherford, 8.45 for Brandon Sorensen of Iowa. Had a few losses.
Pretty good,
in there.
Though.
Yeah, that's a... Yeah,
yeah, winning by an average of, like, every time out, you're scoring 8 points more than your opponent.
Yeah.
And it's pretty good.
Cordell Norfleet.
Arizona State true freshman, Pac-12 champ, kind of hovered around 500 most of the year.
And what do we say his final record?
Final record was 12-13.
12-13 and a negative 1.12. So averaged a loss by 1 point.
It's about what you would expect from a guy who finished 12-13, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, right where it needs
to be. He had, I think, a DQ in there. We docked him 22 for a DQ. Yeah. Right, so we counted, I think, defaults and
as long as
DQs,
the match wrestled,
yep. The same as they would be scored as a fall.
So if it was a forfeit, we didn't count it. So there actually has to be some wrestling competition that took place. So if you go out and get your hand raised without anyone a second of time clicking off, we don't count it, which I don't think you should.
I don't know. Maybe that's a debate for another show.
It could be, but I don't think so. I think you have to have to wrestle a match, because a forfeit means nothing happened. You're just getting free data, and I don't think that should happen in my mind.
But what if you're Zane Rutherford and you're overwhelming everybody, mauling everybody, and they don't want to send somebody out against you?
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I understand your point.
See,
he loses
a chance at 22 there.
I agree, or he gets saved from a potential loss, which we know that ain't going to happen. We know that's not going to happen. Dean Heil, who gets ripped on. Everyone talks about how he didn't score many points. Actually, he had a 6.5 on the season, and that included, what, 5 losses, did we say?
Yeah.
5 losses on the season, so he averaged a 6.5. Had some falls in there, got pinned a couple times on the season, but had some 22s, which again we're counting for falls. Tommy Thorne, 3.87, and his record, I think you had the
18
record.
And 13, 18 if I'm not 13. Mistaken.
So that's a pretty high margin there for an 18-13 record.
Three seems like it is reflective of an 18-13 mark, right?
Yeah,
like that's about what an 18-13 guy should be.
You broke down the data. You had a run there of losing by fall, won by fall, won by fall, and lost by fall. So that cancels everything out.
Yeah, he was a lot zero. Of pin or be pinned there, right?
Yeah, he did. And man, that's and we're just giving the 22. The one thing that's hard is what to give the fall. is the 22. We're just saying it's one more point than the maximum you can get for a technical fall. So I don't know if that's the best numerical value, but I think it's fair.
I think it's pretty close. I don't know that you'd, you know, the first thing in my mind was 20. I think 22 is for the reasons you laid out. You can't score more than 21 in a regulation match, and it takes some bizarre circumstances being up 14, going feet to back in the closing seconds and having time expire so you can add on your writing time point.
I agree. So, but, yeah, I think this could be the future of what we do for data. And there is some data right now that uses dual meet scoring. So the most you could get is 6. So they do that where you get 3 for a decision, 4 for major, 5 for a tech fall, 6 for fall. And then the opposite way, if you lose by those amounts and then you average that out, it's okay. It's at least some data, but I think this is a lot better.
I think, Kyle, we're on to something. So I think this is where we get our numbers guy or girl involved, and we start thinking of ways that we can implement a strength of schedule element to this, and then we've got war.
Yeah.
Then we've got war.
Well, could you do, okay, could we just take it like this, do a war and then a war plus, like they do like an ERA plus? Could you do some different metrics so that you have just a straight up?
Let's get to war first.
Okay. But I think this
one
is
step
war
at a time.
I think this is war here. I think this is wins above replacement. I think this is as solid as you can get. I think this is just a pure way to do it. If you want to do strength of schedule, I don't know how to add that in there because that's a tough metric.
This is where we get Jason Bryan and Seton Hall Pirate and we lock them in an office.
And have them hash it out.
And we have them hash it out.
Do you think that track wrestling could implement this metric if we do it and have that cumulative where you can just have some sort of a spreadsheet and it just goes in there just with data and it just creates it just like you do with do with wins and losses?
Like Tom Brands would say, I believe in my guys.
Yeah.
You believe in my guys. I know that they can do this.
I think it's I think this is the future. And I think it's a fun metric because it paints a great picture of who you are as a wrestler.
Yeah, I think so for sure.
I love that. And we just proved
we haven't
it
found an anomaly yet. We've only done 5 and we'll continue to do more. And maybe we pick 5 more for next week's show and we dive into them. So if anybody out there has some suggestions on who we should look into, if there's an outlier that you think somebody out there is an outlier, an anomaly here, we would love to study their numbers.
I think it'd be really cool. Because
right now, what we're seeing, these numbers kind of paint the picture of who these guys were this year. Right?
Yeah. And it kind of numerically says some of these guys that we criticize for keeping it close. And sometimes they do in the tougher matches. I don't know how you eliminate that. Maybe you have a stat where it's just matches that had point value without the fall. Maybe you're able to break it down without pins and see how close it was on that.
But I don't think so, though. I think that skews the picture.
It does. I'm just saying, is there another way you can just have multiple statistics?
I like where you're going with the breaking it down by division.
I think,
but still, it can be apples to oranges when you're talking Division I. You look at the schedule that the guys in the Big Ten wrestle, and that's not the same as maybe some other conferences out there from a strength of schedule standpoint.
But they don't do it in baseball. They don't say you faced a good pitcher here and a poor pitcher here too. So I think you just need to have one stat, and if you go and kick some butt, you go kick some butt. And we saw it with Zane there. 17.2. Unreal. It really is a great picture of what he did this season, because there's a lot of 22s when you were listing them off. It just was like 22, 22, 22 all the time. And some tech falls in there too, some 15s, 18s.
15-0 tech fall hurts his average.
Yeah. That's scary to think about. Unbelievable. That's,
yeah, when he goes out and beats somebody 15-0, it hurts his average.
Yeah. And it would be fun. I think the one we have to do is just that year 2013, have a comparison between Kyle Dake and David Taylor. do their war. Wins above replacement.
Wait,
what that looks like.
Point differential.
Yeah. Aren't we calling this war?
No, we got to add other elements to war.
So you're saying this isn't
the war. We're just getting started. That's okay. What Seton Hall Pirate and Jason have to hash out.
So we're calling this point differential, PD?
This is point differential, yeah. Okay,
this is our PD.
Yep.
PDI, point differential index. Do you want to add the I on there just to make it sound a little cooler?
Or average.
Okay, we can call it average. Yeah. I think that matches what baseball would be. Or basketball.
We're getting
points.
There. We're getting there.
I think that'd be good.
The one thing baseball has that you can just do the run differential without the average is the fact that everybody's competing in 162 games. So it's...
Yeah. But...
You don't need to pull out your calculator and do the math. Like, or maybe you just do it in your mind, Kyle. I think you're a pretty smart guy.
I'm Rain Man. I'm Rain Man. Hey, we got to bring in Sean Bormet. He is the new head wrestling coach at the University of Michigan. He also wrestled there, was a two-time All-American. Sean Bormet, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Hey, we're doing great. You were just at Junior Nationals, spent 3 days there in Fargo, North Dakota. When you go to a great tournament like that where you know there's just a slew of great talent, what are you looking for, Sean?
You know, we're at this point with the nature of recruiting, you know, obviously we're really – starting to identify some of the younger kids, you know, freshmen, sophomores that potentially could fit our needs for the roster. You know, and then we're obviously scrutinizing a lot of the juniors and watching them compete pretty closely, you know, to fill some of the roster needs we have. You know, really we're just looking for kids, you know, love to compete. You know, I think with the freestyle, you know, we're there, you know, I like to be there to watch because I want to see how they're scoring points. You know, the kids that are winning, I want to know how they're scoring and have a good gauge on if some of those skills are how well they're going to translate to the folk style. So I think seeing the wrestling is important. And I just found, you know, I do a lot of recruiting, watch a lot of film on recruits on video, but I think it's hard sometimes to judge true speed on video. So, you know, in Fargo, it's nice because, you know, in those early rounds when it's packed, we're up in the stands, but as the tournament's starting to thin out, we can actually get on the floor and kind of get close to the mats and really, you know, just kind of get a true gauge of their speed and some of the other physical attributes.
Sean, what goes into getting yourself ready to scout at Fargo when you've got, I don't know, 30-plus mats there and everything's happening so quickly? I imagine there's got to be some systems that you have in place to prepare yourself for that. Can you describe what all you do to get yourself ready to scout up there?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely gotten a lot easier with, you know, these, you know, the wrestling websites and being able to, you know, see the upcoming matches on each mat. So that part of it's gotten a lot easier. Most of it starts with our, you know, just kind of internally looking at our roster, you know, several years out, kind of trying to predict, you know, where our needs are going to be, you know, certain cycles. So we're measuring our guys and their growth and how many years they have left and what weight classes are high priorities for like 2019. What are our high priority weights for 2020? You know, so we're kind of correlating our roster needs and then identifying, you know, maybe the top, you know, 5-6 kids around those weights that we think would be a good fit for our program and for our university. And then, you know, we just kind of start dividing up, you know, Kellen Russell, Josh Terrell and I, all three of us were there this year together. So we had pretty good eyes on all the different mats and we were all kind of watching different wrestlers when we were in those earlier rounds. But it's a lot easier to follow once you're there now because of, you know, the different websites and being able to see the mats. And, you know, you sit there with your iPad and you can kind of see what kids are coming up 2-3 bouts out. So it used to be a lot more difficult.
Andy and I have had a lengthy conversation about the subject of folk style versus freestyle, how you can have a folk style match maybe be 3-2, and then a guy can go into a freestyle match and get tech-falled. From your vantage point, why is there such a disparity between what happens in folk style and what can happen in freestyle?
I mean, you know, that the objective is just a little different. I mean, obviously, folk style is very control-based. In order to have to get points, it takes a lot of different, there's different control points. Freestyle is really just about exposure. I mean, that's when there's big swings in points. A lot of times it's just their exposure points, and you don't even necessarily have to have a takedown or control. For example, I was watching the match with Anthony Cassiope and Mason Paris pretty close at heavyweight. I think they're, two of the really top heavyweights. We got a great class of young heavyweights coming up, and a lot of them are going to be in the Big Ten. So it's kind of exciting. But just watching that match, it was, similar. It was, they're actually from a folk style standpoint, they each had one takedown. And a lot of, Cassiope's other points were from, a couple gut wrenches and, an exposure off a front head position. And, so just kind of freestyle positions and exposure versus, true folk style, control points. That's the biggest difference. And, and there's a couple positions, in parterre, like a leg lace and some of these things where, once you get in a hold and a guy starts turning you, points can blow up quickly. And that's from a recruiting standpoint, that's why it's important. I want to see how the points are being scored and, make sure that the skill sets to secure and have control and score points and folks that are going to be there.
Now that you're the new head wrestling coach at Michigan, is there an introductory process that you have to go through? Do you have to make kids aware of who you are? Are they pretty savvy on where you've been and that you've been part of the program for a long time?
Yeah, I think a lot of kids, were familiar just because I've been here and I've been doing a lot of recruiting and, I've been out scouting and I've been, freestyle wise, I've been out, with our guys constantly over the last 7 years. So I think, a lot of kids that are in tune with college wrestling, there's a lot of familiarity, not just with myself, but our entire staff. So that's been a pretty smooth transition. I haven't ran into too many people that weren't aware of the news. And there's a group of kids and really good kids that are emerging and even coaches that, we're pretty familiar and I have good contacts and good networks with most of these different coaches and kids were familiar with me just from the club system too, because I was entrenched in that for so long, and I was in Fargo for, basically I think I've been in Fargo every summer since 2001. So, I got a pretty good base of contacts and familiarity with a lot of the top areas.
Did that process that you had getting the head coaching job, where did that start? Did you have dialogues with Joe McFarland early in the season and you knew this was going to transpire? Did it catch you off guard too?
No, Joe and I had conversations over the years and even when Joe called me and contacted me back in 2011, when I was running, overtime in Illinois, that was part of the initial conversation because, I built up my club, to a very, very high level there. And it was really important to me. So, when he originally called me in 2011, I kind of wanted to know, not just what the initial opportunity was, but, what would the opportunity look like for down the road? And, at a point when he felt like he was ready to retire, would early on, was that part of the conversation that, that he'd be comfortable with, me really trying to pursue that head coaching position with the administration? And, of course he was, he was all for it. And, we've always had a good relationship. So we had conversations, here and there over the 7 years. And, it was important. Obviously I wanted the position. Being at the University of Michigan was, it's kind of a dream job for me. But I also, it was important for me that Joe retired when he felt like it was the right time for him. So there was a couple points we had those conversations. And then, going into this season, we talked a little bit before the season and, he kind of hinted at the fact that he felt like this might be the right year and with the team we had and the guys that he was able to see through. And he talked a little bit about Cleveland. So, I just filed it away and, didn't really think about it. I just wanted to focus on the season and, I had some goals from a coaching standpoint and just wanted to stay focused on our guys. And, once the season was over, then, you know, we talked again and things moved pretty quickly.
Was that your end game? Did you always want to be a head wrestling coach?
You know, it's funny. I didn't really think about it, actually. I mean, even like when I finished wrestling in college, I knew I wanted to compete and wrestle freestyle. And back then, really the only option to do that was to be on a staff somewhere at a college where you could train and have resources. So I went to the University of Wisconsin with Barry Davis, Bart Chelsvig, and Matt Demaray, and then eventually, you know, both the Steiners were there, and we had a really good group there training together. And I really only was there coaching because I wanted to train and compete. I didn't really have a, you know, long-term vision to coach. But then in 1997, it was January, I tore my ACL and I couldn't compete. And I was out for a while and I pretty much just turned all my focus on to coaching our guys. And we had some really good guys back then. And, you know, when I started doing that, I started to realize how much I enjoyed it and how much I enjoyed like really helping develop these guys. And that's when I started to think more about coaching. You know, we had guys like Donnie Pritzloff there and Kevin Wilmot, Corey Wallman, and Cole Clawson, some middleweight guys that I really, you know, I really enjoyed pouring myself into them and seeing them succeed. And that's when I really started to think about coaching. But even at that point, I didn't necessarily know or think about, you know, being a head coach at a college. Cause then I, you know, shortly after that, I opened my club, you know, back in Illinois, and I did that for 12 years and really enjoyed that. But when the opportunity came to go back to Michigan at that point with the different skills I developed, you know, running my club at that point, that's when I really thought, you know, the end mark and the end goal for me would be to become the head coach. You know, and I wasn't sure if that'd be at Michigan or not, but I'd hoped and I'd worked for it to be at Michigan because that was obviously my first choice.
Let's see if you know your wrestling trivia here. You were a finalist in the 1994 NCAA Championships at 158 pounds. Along with you, now that you're the head wrestling coach at Michigan, in your bracket alone, there were four other Division I head wrestling coaches that came out of that bracket. Can you name the other four?
Oh, boy.
I mean, isn't that cool? I mean, think about that. That's the crown jewel of wrestling, to be a D1 coach, and you had four other ones beside yourself in the bracket?
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. I have to think about that. Let me think. I know I assume you're including me in that four.
No, there's five including you, so there's four
okay,
others.
Okay, so four other guys. Yeah. Well, let's see. Let me think. So I'm trying to think of the guys I wrestled first. Well, Dan Wernsberger, right?
Yep, that's one.
I don't even know, to be honest with you. I mean, I've always thought about how, and I've told our guys sometimes, like the bracket I had my senior year actually was probably the most difficult like path and bracket I had of all my 4 years of college.
Well, yeah.
You know, you can't always assume as you get older, it gets easier because it doesn't. You know, year to year, there's always new guys coming in to each weight class, you know?
Well, yeah. And I'm going to give you the answers here. So you said Dan Wernsberger, Scott Goodell was in that bracket.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And then also Tony Roby was in that bracket. And let's see, Scott Goodell, Dan Wernsberger, Tony Roby. And now I'm missing one too. You. And we got to see who else. I'll figure it out here. But those are the four I came up with. Jim Andrusy. There you go. There was the other one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you know, five out of your bracket.
I don't even, you know, I never really studied the bracket. I just know who I had to wrestle, and I didn't wrestle those guys. So I knew, you know, I wrestled. I remember, you know, I had Joe Williams in the quarters, and I had Marcus Malik on the semis, and I had Pat in the finals. And those three racked up a lot of NCAA titles. So those are the guys I remember.
Yeah, nine titles between three guys. That's not too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a tough way, and it was a great bracket. And even, you know, Earl Walker was in that bracket. You know, so it was, that's impressive. I didn't know. That's a great stat.
What was it like going into that match, knowing that you were going up against a guy in Pat Smith, going for his fourth NCAA championship history? You were on that, the other end. What was that like going into a piece of history there that no one, everyone wanted it to happen except for maybe you?
Yeah. You know, I didn't really think about him going for the four titles. I mean, I had competed against Pat, before, you know, in high school at the junior nationals, our senior year. We wrestled in Vegas the year before our junior year. Or maybe it was a senior year. Well, we wrestled in Vegas once and we wrestled in the All-Star match once. I mean, for me, it was just, you know, I knew he was a good, you know, he's a great competitor. And, you know, early on, I didn't follow wrestling as close, as probably some other really good kids in high school, you know, so I didn't, until I got closer to junior nationals my senior year, I didn't, you know, I really wasn't that aware that, you know, how good his, you know, his brother was. And like, you know, I just really didn't pay that close attention to those things. But, you know, then I started to realize, like, you know, the great opportunities he had at a very young age, you know, being around John and being around Kenny Monday and some of these other great wrestlers that were much older, and having that exposure and being able to, like, you know, I'm sure he was training with those guys a little bit, or at least rolling around and being on the mats with, around them. And what a great opportunity that was at a young age for him. So I knew, and it made sense to me why he was so good young.
Right.
You know, and then through college, really just, you know, obviously I wanted to win an NCAA title going into my senior year, because I fell short my junior year, and ended up third. But, you know, so for me, I was just mostly focused on what I needed to do to beat him and wanting to win my own title. I didn't necessarily think so much about trying to prevent him from winning four. It was more about winning mine. So, but he was a great competitor, and he drove my level of wrestling way up, because he was at such a high level coming into college that, you know, he technically and tactically, he was very, very good. So he definitely raised my level quite a bit, knowing that he was the guy I always had to beat.
All right. Let's test your trivia a little bit more. I think you'll get this one. In 1993, as you said, you placed third, you were the number two seed. The number one seed now has a connection with one of your athletes. Do you know who the number one seed was in 1993?
Yeah, Matt Lindland.
Yep.
Yep. I remember clearly, because I remember warming up for my first round match, and I remember watching him wrestle Earl Walker. And I wrestled Earl Walker at the beginning of the year at the Ohio Open, first round of the tournament. And I had no idea who he was. And all of a sudden, I found myself in a really tight match. And I ended up going to a sudden victory, and I beat him. But I knew how good he was then. And when I saw Matt drew him first round at the NCAAs, I remember just thinking in my head, like, wow, that's a tough first round match. And if Lindland doesn't know who this kid is, he's going to find himself in a war. And sure enough, I was warming up for my match, because obviously I was at the bottom of the bracket being the number two seed. And just, I watched Earl Walker beat him pretty handily and really catch him off guard. And then, you know, I ended up getting upset in the quarters, and then I had to beat Earl in the blood round to continue wrestling. So I remember that pretty clearly.
Sean, how did overtime get started, and how have you seen the club system change in the period of time since you launched that club?
You know, my idea to start it really started, around 97, 98. It was when I had my ACL. So Barry had me out doing a little more recruiting, traveling and recruiting, because I wasn't able to train. And I actually went out to New Jersey, and I went to the Edge, which was really the first club of that kind. Ernie Monaco was the first guy to really do it. And I went out there to watch practice and watch Donnie Pritzloff and Griff Powell, and there was a few good kids there, and he had around the weights we were recruiting. So I flew out there and went to the club and spent some time there watching some training. And, you know, I was focused on the recruiting and watching these guys. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, like, this seems like a great system. And it's definitely something I feel like could work back in Chicago where I grew up, because I think you need a certain population, you need a certain, like, investment in the sport to pull it off. But I just kind of followed away in the back of my head, you know, and then I kept competing for a couple of years. And then 99-2000, I went back to the University of Michigan for 1 year. Joe McFarland got the head coaching job and called me, and I came back to be an assistant that year. And during that year, I started thinking more about the club, and I was getting ready, you know, after that year, whether I won and made an Olympic team or didn't, I was going to be finished wrestling and start moving forward professionally. And I decided that I was going to go back to Chicago and start a club. similar to what I saw Ernie Monaco do. So I started reaching out to some high school coaches, and you know, my wife does surf at the time when I she wasn't my wife then, but I met her and she did survey research, at the University of Michigan. She helped design some surveys and some different, informational, you know, tools that I sent out to a bunch of the local coaches and high school and club coaches around the Chicagoland area that really kind of helped me steer some decisions on whether I thought it would work and then how to structure it. So, you know, at that point, you know, after Olympic trials that year, we relocated to Chicago and you know, I was fortunate to really early on get connected with some great families that were really invested in wanting this to happen for the state. And, you know, they all had kids, so they really wanted to see a greater opportunity for their kids. And the momentum just started, and there wasn't really anything like that. So I had some hurdles, you know, there's some resistance with, you know, I think coaches and other people just in around wrestling that they felt very conflicted that someone was actually trying to charge more money for wrestling and make a living on wrestling, rather than having the wrestling piece just be on the side. So I had some hurdles to get over, from a perception standpoint. And then there were some hurdles I had to get over because it's very territorial. It's very competitive in Illinois at the kids level. So I think a lot of club coaches at the youth level thought I was going to try to create some super team that I was going to compete with and try to take over the whole state. I really had no intention to do that. I actually never had a competitive club, from a youth level. We would go compete as a group at some of the national events, but I was never interested in competing within the state against all the other clubs and coaches and things like that. I just wanted to kind of be an umbrella training facility where the real motivated kids could go train and get a little extra training throughout the year and maybe have some higher caliber partners in the off season and maybe really have an opportunity to focus for several months on freestyle leading up to some of the bigger competitions. So, you know, once I got that early, probably the first couple of years, I kind of had to fight some of those battles a little bit and try to educate people more about what I wanted to do and what my vision was. And then it really took off, and, you know, it was a really, really enjoyable, 11, 12 years. I learned a ton about the sport, on and off the mat, super valuable 11, 12 years and super, enjoyable for me.
What goes into a successful wrestling club?
Well, I think, you know, at your core, you gotta be in it for all the right reasons. You know, I had to make a lot of decisions along the way about, you know, whether I just want to make more money at certain times or be driven more by, you know, the money part, you know, and although that's important and it's super important for you to be able to sustain what you're trying to do and sustain your operation. But at the end, it was really, I always try to make my decisions about what was the right thing for wrestling and what was the right thing for all the kids and the families in our program. So that was kind of the driving force. And I think people, once they get close to it and they're seeing it on a daily basis, I think it's very important that that's what they see. That you care first and foremost about the process that you're going through with their kids and them as a family. And then also, you know, that all that is in tune with what are the right things for our sport at the different levels. You know, and then you got to put a lot of time in. I mean, you got to love to train the kids and you got to love creating that positive environment for them. You got to like being on the road coaching and watching them compete. So it's a huge time commitment. You know, and then when you're running it more like a business, you gotta learn the other aspects. You know, I had to, you know, figure out how to do the marketing and make that right. And make it in line with what I wanted. You know, a lot of customer service, because, you know, I had some people asking me that same question this weekend. Actually, I was in Fargo, and I explained to them that, you know, a lot of the time you spend, you know, you're working with a lot of families that, you know, their kids are just getting into the sport or they're just starting to have a little success. So there's a lot of questions and a lot of, you know, areas along the way, you got to help maybe educate them a little bit on what the next step might look like and what the process, you know, looks like on more of a natural scale. And it doesn't always pay off to try to rush the process of success in our sport. And, you know, and so there were a lot of conversations, a lot of time just spending, you know, spending time face to face with people talking about these things and helping them, helping mentor them be better parents for their kids in the sport of wrestling. That was a big part of it. And I think those were the things. And obviously our staff, I mean, I built a staff. It started out just me. And then, I hired, you know, John Kading and Kerry Bowman's and, you know, and Donnie Reynolds and Ed Geese. And we slowly started to continue to build like a bigger staff as the club was growing and, you know, picking the right people and making sure that their vision, and you know, that their, the way they were invested in the sport and the kids is all, you know, we were all on the same page. And that was one of the things that, you know, ultimately like was one of the most gratifying parts of it for me was when I started the club to when I finished, you know, really I created basically four full-time positions in the sport of wrestling that didn't exist before. And, you know, now it's great to see, I think the club system and that profession has really exploded. And I think a lot more people are doing it. And it really, it just, it's created a lot more opportunities to, you know, have a salary and make a profession within our sport that isn't necessarily attached to like a college program or a high school program.
You grew up in Illinois. What was your upbringing like? What was your family environment like?
You know, I grew up, you know, my father was a union plumber. And, you know, my mom pretty much just focused on, you know, she was at home taking care of me when I was young and she worked part-time. Like, there's a couple like local hotels in like a kind of smaller community in the south suburbs of Chicago. And, you know, she would clean hotel rooms. So pretty much a very blue collar upbringing. You know, we were kind of lived in a very blue collar area. I mean, it's, you know, I had no air conditioning, we had, I think three TV channels growing up. I mean, it wasn't, but I didn't think much of it because that's kind of how it was around our neighborhood and the area we lived. And, but it was, you know, I was pretty active. My dad started me. I actually wanted to play hockey when I was about 8. I came home with a hockey flyer from school and my dad, like literally like the next day I was staying on a wrestling mat, cause ice time was too far away. And, you know, the sport, I think the point of entry in the sport was a lot more expensive at the time. And my dad wrestled through high school. And, so he got me into wrestling and, you know, all my friendships quickly were formed through wrestling. I really, you know, I loved it right away. And my dad and some other dads started a club when I was, you know, probably by fifth grade, they started a club and, kind of grew that. And, you know, I had a lot of great memories just competing and traveling. And that was a big part of my life was doing things as a family and doing things with these other teammates of mine and their families. So, you know, that was a big part of like growing up for me, in the sport. And then, you know, when I came to high school, I had to make a decision to go to the public school or go to the private school, which was right down the road, which was Providence Catholic High School in New Lenox, Illinois. And, you know, after evaluating the two things, it was very clear to me, like Providence was the right decision because they had a very committed coaching staff to the sport of wrestling. And I knew my best opportunities to continue to improve and compete at a high level, we're going to that high school. And my parents made a lot of sacrifices to afford that opportunity to me. So, you know, I was kind of in tune with that stuff. You know, the sacrifices were being made to continue to give me opportunities in the sport. So I was always appreciative and tried to take advantage of them. But it was, you know, from the time I remember, you know, really being 8, it was, you know, really a big part of my life.
Was it a fight for survival upbringing where you had to get in fights and you were in a, you said blue collar, what'd you have to do to just kind of survive through that?
No, I mean, it wasn't like a real tough, like that kind of area. I mean, you know, like there's some areas like little, you know, on the east side of Joliet that were very tough and I had friends that lived in that area. It was very tough, like very tough area, you know, growing up, but the area I was in, it was just more, you know, just blue collar, very, very hardworking, humble families. And, you know, that's, I remember about all my friends' parents too. I mean, just very hardworking families, you know, either like union jobs or, you know, factory jobs. And, you know, so, you know, as kids, I think we had a little more free time. Just our parents were working all the time. And, but we, you know, we spent a lot of time like, you know, working out together. You know, I was lucky. My dad, he put some resources in front of me. I didn't realize when I was a kid, but as I got older in the sport, and especially when I started running my club and started looking at what other parents were doing with their kids, I, you know, I quickly realized, like, my dad, he got a hold of a big wrestling mat, and we had an unfinished basement. He just put a big strip of mat down in our basement. He would, you know, when he'd run across like old used weight equipment, he'd grab it and bring it home and put it in the basement. And so by the time I was probably like sixth, seventh, eighth grade, I would, you know, when my friends would come over, that's what we would do. We'd go down the basement and wrestle around, or we'd lift weights, and, you know, we'd be looking at weightlifting books and trying to figure out what we should be doing. I mean, we had to kind of learn it and teach ourselves. But the one thing that stood out is my dad never was down that basement with me. He was never standing over me, making me do all these things. He just put them down there. And once in a while, he'd say, well, you know, if you want to be better, why don't you put more time into this or that? But he never stood over me and made me do these things. It was always my choice. And I think it really helped me develop my own internal drive to work and improve and excel. And, you know, then that was something my friends and I always did. I mean, we were constantly wrestling in that basement and constantly, you know, if we weren't doing that, we were running around outside playing football or fishing. And so it was, you know, from that standpoint, I think it was a pretty normal, you know, upbringing.
Wrestling people, especially wrestling coaches, are known for having laser beam focus on wrestling. No, for Andy and I, the majority of our conversations revolve around wrestling. We can talk about baseball too and a few other things. Where do you fall in that spectrum? And if we had a conversation other than wrestling, what would we be talking about, Sean?
Well, if you're talking with me, I could probably participate a lot if it was anything, somewhat in, you know, music or weightlifting. Those are probably the only two hobbies I've had. I mean, I don't really follow other sports a lot. I do watch college football, and I've always been pretty in tune with the teams in Michigan. So I follow, you know, their teams pretty closely. I've always been a laser focused guy in wrestling. I mean, some of the guys on our team, they laugh when I tell them stories. Like I never hit a baseball until I was 28 years old that I hit a batting cage while I was doing a wrestling camp right next to one. I never had a mitt, never had a ball, never had a bat growing up. I couldn't name any professional football players in the last like 15 years. I don't watch it. You know, I don't like, same with baseball. I went to my first, you know, growing up in the South suburbs of Chicago and having the Cubs and the Sox, I went to my first baseball game. Basically that was like it was the summer of 2011. You know, I was like 40 years old when I went to my first baseball game. And then I just, you know, those things, I appreciate them, but they don't really captivate my interest. You know, I'm pretty much laser focused on wrestling, and I enjoy other things. But let's face it, in this sport, you have to put a lot of time in, and it's a working man sport. You got to like to work, and you got to like to hone your craft, whether you were as an athlete or as a coach. I think, you know, I'm a guy I'm constantly trying to improve myself, and I know the more I can do that, the more I can improve the people I'm trying to help, and it's what I really love. So. You couldn't talk to me about a lot of other things, probably.
Well, I see. I always thought you would have been good at mixed martial arts if you would have given it a crack.
Well, yeah, you know, it came around early. I did have one MMA fight.
You did? Huh.
I did. And it's quite the story. It was literally, it was back when we had the restricted earnings positions, and that's where I was at Wisconsin. So our salaries were limited at the time to $12,000 a year. That's all we could make. It was the NCAA maximum. It was $12,000 a year, and you could make up to $4,000 at summer camp. So the max you could make as an income was $16,000. So the year in 1997, I tore my ACL. You know, I was out for a while, and as I started to come back, it was probably like July or August, I was starting to like be able to drill and get on the mat and do some things, but it was right when MMA was starting to, starting to grow quite a bit, like at least within some of the U.S. wrestling. Rico Ciparelli and his brother started a little like organization, and they called some guys, and they had Lin-Lin and Randy Couture, Dan Henderson, and I think Mike Van Arsdale, and then myself. And they were trying to put together a team of wrestlers that would maybe get into MMA. And I was a little leery about it. And obviously back then, there wasn't, you know, like the internet wasn't real, advanced at that point. And I didn't have a computer or internet at that point. So it wasn't like you could do a lot of research. Well, these guys called me like late July or August. And, they said, "Hey, would you like to go down to Brazil with us and enter a competition? And if you win, you get 10 grand. And all I heard was the 10 grand, because I knew that would almost double my salary for the year. And at the time, you know, you're trying to compete and travel, and we had support, but it wasn't the same now, you know, as these guys with the RTCs and all the bigger clubs that are paying for all your trips. I mean, it was much more like, you're living week to week here. So all I heard was the 10 grand. I'm like, I don't know. I said, I've been out for a while, and you know, my ACL, I'm just starting to get back on the mat. I'm trying to get ready for the Sunkist tournament, which is at the end of October. And I'm like, I don't have like any training for this stuff. And they're like, "Oh no, it's just this, it's a jujitsu guy. You know, these guys aren't very good." And they're like, Rico's like, "I'll come in, I'll spend a couple weeks with you. And I'll show you how to defend some of these jujitsu positions." And he's like, you're going to kill this guy. And I'm like, "Nah, I don't know, you know." And he's like, so he talked me into it. And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And it was supposed to be like a 170-pound weight class, which is, you know, I competed at 163, and I probably walked around at like 180. So it was literally 2 weeks later. So Rico comes in, he shows me how to defend a couple different jiu-jitsu positions. All I did was wrestling. And we get down to Brazil, and all of a sudden, all these things start changing. Like the weight class changed. It was like 185. So the guy was coming down from like 205. Then there was no gloves. It was bare knuckles, like no gloves. And I'm worried about like injuring, breaking a bone in my hand. And I'm trying to get ready for Sunkist. And I just missed like 6 months with my ACL. So then also the guy that set the whole thing up was the ref. That was the other interesting part. He was the official. And so the guy I ended up fighting in Brazil was Vanderlei Silva. and he wasn't a jiu-jitsu guy, I found out quickly. And he was basically completely like oiled up. So when I started, like right in the beginning, when I started trying to grab him and wrestle him, he was completely oily. So I couldn't get a grip on anything. And the oil was in all over my hands. And, you know, at one point I'm like, you know, I could quickly tell his striking was like, you know, very advanced, and I was in way over my head, in that department. And I wasn't sure how I was going to take him down because he was all oily, you know, and in the end, like quickly, like within like probably the first couple of minutes, I ended up kind of panicking and shooting right into a leg kick, and it didn't knock me out, but it wobbled me and they stopped it right away, but which was probably a good thing for me at that point. But I was so turned off by how corrupt it all was and felt to me and how they cheated kind of. Like, I was so turned off by it, I didn't want anything to do with it. You know, so I got back and I just got back to focusing on my wrestling and, you know, trying to make the 2000 Olympic team. But so that was my one experience. Maybe if my experience was different, I would have pursued it more. But, you know, it's definitely an interesting story.
Well, you have a guy that is experiencing a lot of success in two different styles, Greco-Roman and freestyle. Adam Kuhn, what a great story. Almost capped it off with a double world team. Fell a little short in the world team trials for freestyle. But, man, what a great run he's had. Take us through what that looked like as far as just his desire to go both styles and then just getting to this level where he's successful in both.
Yeah, Adams, you know, he loves to compete and he thrives on challenging himself. That's just kind of how he's wired. What makes him so special. I knew early on, you know, when we were recruiting him to the University of Michigan, I knew he was going to be a two-style guy, and he always has been. And he loves to compete, and I think he's really good in both styles. When we saw the schedule, I knew there were going to be significant challenges for him to not just train leading up to that weekend, but also, you know, the logistics of competing in Tulsa, traveling through the night and then competing again the next day. We're going to pose some physical challenges for him. But, you know, through all the conversations, and I challenged him on it a little bit just to make sure, like in his heart, that's what he wanted to do. You know, 10 times out of 10, he came back saying, I want to do it. You know, so I was all for it, supporting him. You know, we put together as creative of a training plan as we could, tried to make the travel as smooth as we could. You know, and I think he did a great job, making adjustments to beat Robbie and wrestled two great matches out there against Robbie. You know, and he did a great job mentally trying to get himself ready for the next day in the freestyle and the final X. But at the end, you know, it's not to take anything away from Nick, but at the end of the day, he just didn't have that much gas in his tank. His legs were a little heavy, and, you know, and he expressed that to me even just in his warm up, and I could see the way he was moving. I mean, it was just, you know, he was definitely a step off. And, you know, I'm proud of him. He put a great effort in. I would, you know, unfortunately for him, he had to do all that in a 3-day period and cut weight all 3 days. I would have really liked to seen him be able to have, you know, a real fair opportunity to compete on two different weekends. Would have been nice, even if they were just a week apart. I would have liked to seen him have that opportunity. I mean, there were 3 weekends for Final X. I would have liked to seen his be a different weekend, maybe the one in Nebraska, so that, you know, he could have competed. And then, you know, the first one, and then maybe 2 weeks later, wrestled Greco. But, you know, that wasn't in the cards. And, you know, so we just did the best, put the best training plan together we could. I think Adam put a great effort in, and Wojdowski wrestled a great match. And he's world-class. I mean, let's face it, he's one of the top heavyweights in the world. You know, I'd like to see Adam wrestle him in freestyle when he's fresh. And I think, you know, he'll have some of those opportunities going forward. But, you know, he definitely had a great run this spring between making the finals of the NCAAs, the world team trials for Greco, and the world team trials for freestyle. That's not done very often.
Does he get double pay being on Greco national team and freestyle?
I believe that is the case. I don't know for sure. I know they've changed some stuff with the stipends in the last couple of years, as UWW's made changes with the Olympic weights and the non-Olympic weights, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. Adam's gone right now. I'll find out when he gets back from his first camp.
Is it strictly Greco for him now until Budapest, as far as his training goes, or is he doing some leg grabbing in the meantime as well?
Yeah, he'll be doing both. I mean, he's it was important to him. He wanted to make sure that the Greco team and staff knew he was, you know, first and foremost committed to his priorities being the world team member. So he's going to, you know, that's going to be his primary focus. But in between, I know he'll be doing freestyle, and he'll be continuing to work on all his freestyle skills. I mean, he's kind of like that. He loves, you know, the balance of that for himself. So I know when he's back here, I know after, you know, if he's three, four weeks straight of the Greco training, he'll be super excited to get in here and do some folk style freestyle wrestling with some of the guys.
Did Kyle Snyder get that takedown in the Big Ten finals over Adam?
You know, it's really tough to say. Watching it slowly, you know, having the opportunity to actually watch it slowly, like frame by frame, to me, it looked like both feet came out before one foot came back in. But at the time, you know, I could have never made that call live, and I don't see the same video that they're necessarily when they do the review. So, you know, given that moment there, it's hard to say what they saw. I mean, they made the call, and I think they made the call they thought was right at the time. You know, I've seen some different angles where it looked like both feet slid out, and then the one foot came back down to the ground and was inbounds. But, I mean, that's neither here nor there. It's, you know, they had some great matches, and I got nothing but respect for Kyle. I mean, I've known him since he won his first junior title. So, you know, I think the world of Kyle, and, you know, those two had some great matches. And I think that series was really good for wrestling at all levels.
You lose Adam Kuhn to graduation, but you still have a solid team coming back. Going in knowing what you have coming back, what's the message to the team going into the 2019 season?
You know, we're just continuing to work off the momentum this past season. You know, I think we had a great season, but our guys, you know, are hungry to win some individual titles. We got some guys that are really hungry and focused on winning titles, you know, and they also know, you know, when that's being done, the opportunities to win team titles increase. So that continues to be our goal. And, you know, that's what the guys are, you know, working and training and doing things throughout the summer with those goals in mind. And then we got a tremendous incoming freshman class. So, you know, having them step into that mindset right away will, I think, continue to springboard our program, you know, towards that goal. You know, I was just out in, like I said, out in Fargo, and we didn't have all of our young guys out there, but, you know, obviously, you know, getting it, you know, these last couple weeks, getting a chance to watch Mason Paris compete at heavyweight. You know, clearly he's got a ton of potential to step in, you know, as he continues to develop and fill in nicely as, you know, as Kuhn is sliding out.
All right. You said you're so focused on wrestling, but I picked up that you also like music. Give us three songs once we finish this show that we can go listen to that we know Sean Bormet endorses. Sean Bormet.
Me. All right. You want three songs at the end of the show?
Is this I want it right now. I got one more question after this, but I want to make sure we get this in.
All right. So you want three songs now, huh?
Yeah. Three songs that we can tune. I mean, Andy will want to listen to them. I will right when we get done. And we just want something to get us motivated going into Wolverine season. Your inaugural season.
Yeah. Well, Hail to the Victors.
Okay.
That's the first one.
All right.
The National Anthem would be number two.
Okay.
And then any song by Pearl Jam.
Okay. So I'm going to pick I Am Mine. You know, you familiar with that one?
Yep.
Okay. That's my favorite Pearl Jam.
I also have a great appreciation for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, especially the drummer. I don't know if you guys ever saw that concert recently where he came out and it was a concert in Columbus, and he came out and did an encore to Hail to the Victors in Columbus. He's a huge Michigan fan.
All right. Well, I'm just going to end with this, just a couple little nuggets here. I know you said you didn't know any football players, but look into a guy named Barry Sanders. He played for the Detroit Lions. He's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I remember Barry Sanders. Okay. I do remember him.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured, but I just got to make sure you know about Barry Sanders. And then, again, this is, to me, you have a lot of connections here, but how unique is it that the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry is one of the great rivalries in all of sport, and the two head coaches right now for the wrestling program wrestle Pat Smith in the finals, you and Tom Ryan. How cool is that?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, we do have, you know, it's a big rival across all sports with them, but I've known Tom, and, you know, we've known each other for a long time, and since we competed in college, so, you know, I got a lot of respect for what they're doing there and their guys, and I know a lot of their athletes, and I've actually worked with some of their athletes at different points, like prior to them getting to Ohio State. So, you know, I think there's a pretty high level of mutual respect between our two programs, but it's also a tremendous rivalry, and it really is across all sports with our schools. So it's a lot of fun to be a part of it.
All right, we appreciate you coming on. We're going to listen to the Jimi Hendrix version of the National Anthem once we get off this program. But thanks for joining us. We wish you all the best in your first season as head wrestling coach at Michigan. We're excited to see what you do.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Appreciate that. That was Sean Bormet, head wrestling coach at Michigan. For Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com, I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.